This is Amy Hall, and we're so glad you're listening to us after we went so long last time. You're back!
That was our Christmas present to you, the extra minutes
yes.
of STR Ask.
So let's start this one with a question from Dandy Prime. What do I do when I'm the only Christian in the house where I live? I don't really talk about my faith with any of my family members because they don't want to hear it, and I want to keep the peace since I live here. Any advice?
Well, I'm completely sympathetic to the situation that Dandy Prime is in. And there was somewhat of a parallel, I guess, with me as a non-Christian and my younger brother being a Christian. Now, my view wasn't then that I didn't want to hear it because I was willing to hear what Mark had to say, but I was also quick to do my best to dismiss his views with standard kind of challenges and objection that I don't recall he was particularly up to. In Mark's case, though, he just persisted. And so if you have a family member who is willing to engage, then keep engaging in an amicable way. And the more you use our tactical game plan that employs questions to navigate in the conversation, the better it's going to be. But my basic rule for myself is if people don't want to hear what I have to say, I'm not going to talk. You know, Jesus said at different times, let him who has ears to hear, let him hear. Now, it wasn't exactly a parallel circumstance to what we're talking about because he was talking with people that were at least attending to his message, his preaching at the moment. But he understood that there are a lot of people that are listening for very different reasons, and maybe they're listening simply because they're skeptics, they're trying to catch him, and that was the case of the Jewish leaders. But nevertheless, people, Jesus understood that some people are there to hear and to pay attention and to listen and to make sense of it and get what good they could, and others were not interested in changing their thinking whatsoever. And when that's the case, I think, especially when it's expressed, listen, I don't want to talk about this stuff. Well, I think then we need to honor that. It doesn't mean that we can't, I mean, if you think of the metaphor of an open and closed door, they're closing the door on us. It doesn't mean we can't keep leaning on it a little bit until they turn the latch and then we're in again. So I think it's good for us. And Mark was like this too, you know, when I finally brushed him off. Well, then I don't recall that he kept chasing me down the street. But I knew that he was there as a presence for the gospel in my life. And so there was this he was taking opportunities to make reference to it when he could. So I think that when you have a family whose individual members say they don't want to hear it, well, then you honor that, but you're ready, like I said, you're kind of leaning against the door that's closed. So if there's a little crack in the door that they leave, then you're ready to move in and to do something and to say something that might move them forward. And so there's a little bit of a balance here. You back off, but you don't go away. Maybe that's the best way of putting it. That's what I would suggest. Mm-hmm. So let me just look at the question again to make sure I covered it. My family members, they don't want to hear it, and I want to keep the peace. You know, keeping the peace is a huge biblical value. It says in Romans 12, I think, it says, as far as it's possible, if possible, as far as it's within your power, be at peace with all men. And it says two things. For one, it's not going to always be possible, and it's not always going to be within your power. But insofar as it is, you want to seek peaceful relationships. This is true in the circumstance described here. This is true with children, with one's own children, and one's own spouse. I mean, I have to assess this all the time as a dad and a husband, where taking leadership creates turmoil, and I have to ask myself, is this turmoil justified enough that I violate the principle of maintaining peace in my home? So that's always a struggle that parents mm-hmm. have to deal with, I think. But notice the value, peace. And this value is all through the Scriptures, particularly in New Testament. scriptures. There are lots of places where it talks about this notion. So I think that Dandy Prime is moving in the right direction to honor or to protect the notion of peace in the relationships. Yet it can't be peace at all costs, because there are some things that are more important than peace. And this is why there's that tension then of being available, ready to have some kind of influence where you're able to have influence regarding the gospel.
And if they're open to talking about what they believe, then asking questions about what they believe and just talking to them about what they think will just at least get them thinking about that area of...
That oils the conversation a little bit. And also, my suggestion is it's although there's exceptions to this, sometimes it's better to have these kinds of discussions one-on-one than as a group. So if you're talking around Christmas dinner or something, well, these things may come up. But it's easy for the non-believers to gang up on the believers, and it's not a pretty picture. And you know, there's no good progress that's being made. So if it's Christmas time and the family is not a believer and you're the only believer, what you might say is, you know, would you mind if I gave thanks to God for our Christmas day and our Christmas meal? Everybody, nobody else has to give the amen. All they have to do is bow their head respectfully or even not bow their head while you do this. And when we do that, when we give thanks, it's an opportunity to express thankfulness to God in a way that reflects the intimacy of our relationship with Him. So we're not just running off a rote prayer. That's a big mistake in this circumstance. It'll reinforce the wrong ideas. Religion is just about rote activity. But rather you say something that is personal and intimate and honorable and honors the family. That is not only a good prayer to God, but it also could have a salutary effect as people realize, well, this isn't just religious dogma and religious perfunctory conduct, but it's a genuine, heartfelt relationship that's being expressed here.
I think there's a huge value in just living out your Christian life where they can see it, not in a way that's trying to impress them or show them, but just openly. Mm-hmm. You know, read your Bible. They'll know what you're doing even if you're not saying it, and I think that will matter to them. So just don't hide what you're doing. Don't flaunt it either, but you know, live in front of them. Live your life. Let them hear how you're thinking through decisions and how. If you're praying about it or what your concerns even are, sometimes Christians have concerns that people who aren't Christians don't even have. So even to hear you thinking about them will make an impression mm-hmm. on them. And of course, pray for them. Obviously, mm-hmm. that goes without saying. But I was thinking about something Peter says in 1 Peter 3 to wives who have husbands who are not Christians. And here's what he says.
This is dangerous territory. Here, just saying.
In the same way, you wives, be submissive to your own husbands so that even if any of them are disobedient to the word, they may be won without a word by the behavior of their wives as they observe your chaste and respectful behavior. And so
and there's also a line there about calling him Lord, you know, just saying.
But sure, get us off
but
track.
There's a broad, I'm not. There's a broad picture of deep respect and obedience as a witness for Christ.
And the idea that as you are obedient to Christ in your behavior, that has an effect on those that you can't speak to mm-hmm. that, about these things.
That aren't interested in listening.
Yeah. They might be one without a word by your behavior. Mm-hmm. So Peter talks a lot about how our behavior expresses who God is and how it glorifies God and how when the non-believers see what we do when God comes, that we will, that they will glorify him for your good deeds. Mm-hmm. So he talks a lot about how behavior affects non-believers. Mm-hmm. So that's something to keep in mind. In case you feel like you're doing nothing, they're actually watching you and who you are and what you do.
The recommendation to offer the prayer for the family is an example mm-hmm. of that. You're just living that out before them. This is an historical sidelight. on this observation from Peter. This is precisely what happened, as I understand it, when the Roman Empire fell and the heathen from the north, you know, took over and captured all of these women and carried them off as wives, carried them north. Well, a lot of these women that were captured were Christians, because they were slaves, they were whatever they were, but they were Christians. And what ended up happening is a lot of these guys became believers because of this conduct. And so this moved the gospel. In other words, the wives that were captured and made wives of these pagans that were coming from the north and dragged back, then they lived out their Christianity in such a way that the husbands ended up getting converted. But now they're getting converted not in Rome, but in the northern regions, in Central Europe. And so this is an odd way that the gospel went forth, okay? I mean, this is part of the historical development of that area, and we don't think about that so much. But there are lots of circumstances like this, just like the persecution of the church early on in Jerusalem forced them out of Jerusalem into Judea and Samaria and the uttermost parts of the earth, which is what God had intended. The persecution was one of the things that caused that.
All right, let's go on to a question from Mr. Kohlmeister. I'm a new father, and I've been thinking about how to raise my son. How do I strike a balance between raising him up in the knowledge of and obedience to the Lord versus letting him freely choose to follow the faith?
All right, I'm just thinking the best way to put this. Dads and moms who have been around for a while will understand this, I think, more than new parents. This is going to sound a bit harsh in light of the mentality of the age right now, okay? When I was in high school, this is when it became, in the 60s, that it became cool to address adults by their first name. Okay, the idea was egalitarianism, you know. Oh, yeah, you're not better than me. I'm a kid, but you're just older, but you don't have any higher station, so I should be allowed to address you in any way. And a lot of the adults went along with that because it was cool, and it was part of the spirit of the age of egalitarianism, okay? Now, I was taught differently. You respect adults because adults have earned the respect in virtue of their station. I mean, they make sacrifices that children don't have to make, okay? And they take responsibility and they get things done and they solve problems and they make way for others. They take care of, okay? That's what adults do, at least in principle. Not so much anymore because of the changing thing. Okay, so what this means then for application is adults don't let kids decide for themselves. Kids don't know how to decide. I'm talking about a general rule. Kids don't know how to decide for themselves. That is a secular view. It's not even a human view. Human beings have understood this for a long time, regardless of their religion. But now the secular view is everybody's equal. This is one reason they want to lower the voting age, you know, because, kids, anyway, that's another issue, but it moves in this direction. Why are we allowing kids to make all these decisions? Who they believe, what they believe, no, we don't. We tell them what to do because we know better. Now, it doesn't mean we're perfect, but on balance, we know better. And so we raise them up with the wisdom that we have as adults to do what we know to be good for life. We don't let them do what they want to do, and we don't let them believe what they want to believe at this point. We guide them in what is true and right and good in all areas, not just in the area of, I'm going to call it faith. The reason some people have treated that as a separate category, where we'll direct them in behaviors that we think are good in other areas, but when it comes to faith, they subjectivize and relativize faith. And since, it's just whatever, it's your flavors, you have your own flavor, and so who am I to say what flavor they should have? Well, if you're a Christian, we know this isn't flavors. This is the nature of reality, and we're teaching them about reality. When they grow up, they're going to have a point where they're going to have to decide whether what they were taught by their parents is true or sound or accurate or not, according to their own sensibilities as an emerging adult, all right? They're going to have to own that for themselves. That time will come. Until that time, We don't let them do whatever they want. We tell them what the truth is, whether it's about religion or whether it's about mathematics or about responsibility or whatever it is. Why? Because, on balance, adults know better. I know that sounds quaint. I know that sounds outdated, but it's a fact of reality. And the book of Proverbs talks about this, too. The wisdom of old men is their gray hair. And the point is, you're older, you're wiser. Okay, and this is what we want to convey to our children. So I do not think that we are doing anything amiss by telling them the truth about the world in every area, and especially the most important areas. There is a God to whom we're beholden, and that God has given me responsibility over you, honey, and it's my job to guide you. And as long as you're in our under our care, then you're going to have to live the way we think is best for you. Now, I have teenagers. I got a teenager now and getting close. My second one is going to be 12, so that's like a tween, I guess. Tomorrow is her birthday. But but this is a fight that we have to have. Now, my dad used to say, you know, it's my house. I pay the bills. It's my way or the highway. You know, that's kind of the way he described it. It was not a good way to say it, I think, but it was a good principle. The way I tell my daughters is, your mom and I have responsibility over you. It is our job to care for you and protect you. And so we're going to do that until it's not our job to do anymore. And as long as you are under our care and protection, then we are going to teach a certain thing and we're going to live a certain way. When you're your own person, then you can move your own way. But we want them to have the benefit of the wisdom of our age and experience when it comes to that time that they start making their own decisions. And by the way, it doesn't mean that the kids make no decisions until they're 18 and then they're gone. And frankly, the legal age is not important to me. It is that generally we are making those decisions and guiding them, but as time goes on, we are giving them more latitude to start making choices for themselves. But it's guided, because we are mentoring them in life. And so we are helping them, watching over them while they make the decisions little by little that they begin to own. But that takes time.
Mm-hmm. I think it's where it gets tricky, I think, for people. Obviously, training them in knowledge, that's very straightforward. You're telling them the truth. You're teaching them all these things. Training them in behavior, I think, is where it starts to get tricky, because there is a difference between someone who is saved and someone who is not saved and their motivations for what they're doing. And if your kids are starting off not saved, as we all do, the tricky thing is not teaching them through training them in behavior that what they're some kind of a works righteousness. So I think you have to be careful to make sure they understand the grace as much as they understand the obedience. Mm-hmm. And so that, I think, can be tricky. And also, I mean, I think about how well-trained I was. And even though I wasn't really following God in high school or junior high or anything, I never rebelled because I had been taught what was good. And that saved me so much heartache. Mm-hmm. That I saw other people go through who weren't trained in that way. So if you can instill a love of goodness, mm-hmm. and a love of wisdom and a desire to do what's good, I think that's really helpful. And but if you're teaching them, if you don't do this, you're going to get in trouble with God, which I hope. I don't think that's how people do it, but I think that could be more dangerous for people who are not saved, and they come to, you know, Paul talks about the law just causes you to desire to sin. And so anyway, I think it's very tricky to help them to understand grace as you're training them in what's good. And so I understand the difficulty of that. And also, what are you making them do? Are you making them, you know, obviously do what's right, but are you making them then go to church? Are you making them read the Bible a certain amount of time or pray a certain amount of time? I mean, I think it's really tricky to know where to stop with those things if your child is not mm-hmm. saved.
Well,
what
in
do
the
you
case
think about
of
that?
Our 15-year-old who makes no pretensions to being a Christian at the moment, what we've explained to her is that we're a Christian family and you're part of our family. And one of the things that we do is we go to church. Now, you can believe what you want to believe. So she's at a stage in her life where now she's starting to form her own convictions. You can believe what you want to believe. We are not going to force you to pray. In fact, you don't have to even pay attention to the sermon. But you have to comport yourself in a way that's dignified and respectful of the people around you. So you can't read, Rick Riordan, while you're, or Harry Potter or something during the service. If you want to sketch in a notebook, looks like you're taking notes or something, you can do that. If you want to write things, you can do that. But you can't read something else while you're sitting. That's not polite. And so this is kind of a way that we're doing it. There are certain parameters that being part of our family are required. I actually don't. This is another point here. I know we're going a little bit long, but just wanted to offer some thoughts about this because these are all related and they're critical. That I don't think we teach kids to love virtue. I think we teach kids to do virtuous things, and the love of virtue comes from the Aristotle had a word for it, where we phronesis or something like that. That the idea that it becomes habituated in us, and then we love the thing for itself. That we instill wisdom as we're talking with them, and we teach them wisdom like from the scripture or something like that. But at the same time, we are requiring of them good behavior, which they don't want to do. We are requiring of them. But one example, my daughter doesn't like to clean a room, but we have kind of enforced some standards there, and she didn't like it. She fights against it. But then she said she went to her friend's house, and their room was dirtier than hers was, messier, and that bothered her a little bit. So in the process of trying to make her do these things that are annoying to her, I think it instills in her a love for some of these things that I think ultimately are virtuous, like orderliness. And so God took chaos and made order out of it, kind of thing. So I'm just making the point that sometimes we require these things of them, and as they practice them, then they mm-hmm. learn the fulfillment of doing the thing for its own sake. But that takes time.
I think they also see in their parents, if they have a love for what's good and what's motivating them to do what's good, if they have a love of wisdom and they desire it versus they just don't want to do anything wrong. I think that kind of thing is catching, even if you are making her do it.
If the parents have a love for these things, yes, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, if we do virtue because we want to be virtuous people, I think that is contagious, mm-hmm. right? But it starts out, in terms of moral mm-hmm. development, it starts out with a very kind of animal motivations, pleasure and pain. That's how you start out, and you make demands, and then these things form the habits, okay? Mm-hmm. It's like a piano. What kid likes to go na 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 na? It's a pain, but in the process of doing it, they gain a freedom that they would not have had. And this is J.P. Moreland language. Okay, you gain a freedom by making sacrifices early on because it builds something into yourself that then gives you liberty later that brings satisfaction. That's a virtuous life.
Well, thank you, Greg, and thank you everyone for your questions. Please keep sending us those questions on Twitter. The hashtag is #SDRAsk, and we look through those and we pick them out and then we answer them. So keep in touch with us. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.